Iran's Progressive Radio News Hour. Ahead of the new year, I wish all my listeners a happy new year. I honestly don't see very much good coming in it, but you know, I enter every day. I begin every day with hope. I never lose hope. And I say to myself and I say to others, if you lose hope, you lose everything. If you lose hope, you stop working for something that's better. Larry Pinkney, I don't want to say hi, Larry, before I introduce you. I've never done that before. Larry Pinkney is my guest today. Larry has been on a number of times before. I certainly hope he'll be on many times in the future. And he's a wonderful guest, and he's lived some of the tough life that he can talk about firsthand, things that other people like myself read about and write about, but we never lived it. And it really shows what a grim place America is, how brutally unfair, and how it harms people. It should be going all out to help, and it certainly is more so today than any time in my lifetime. And I honestly don't see things getting any better, Larry.
Well, I want to thank you for having me, first of all, my brother, as a guest once again. It's always so wonderful to look forward to the program and to be on your program. As far as things getting any better, the only way that things are going to get better will not be by osmosis. It will only be by people waking the heck up, waking up, looking at reality, and then changing that reality in one that really serves the interests of everyday, ordinary black, white, brown, red, and yellow people and our precious, precious planet of Mother Earth.
Well, there's no question, Larry. If you look at the history of the world, you'll discover that with very rare exceptions, and I consider Venezuela one of them under Hugo Chavez and continuing under Nicolas Maduro, certainly not paradise, but far better than what goes on around most of the rest of the world, maybe all of the rest of the world, but virtually in every other case, or in virtually all cases, and you get some exceptions that prove the rule, but virtually always the only time change ever comes is when people decide on their own that they're going to make it happen. And I don't mean by bomb throwing or shooting people or raising all kinds of hell. There are lots of ways to make a change happen. You can do it nonviolently. You can do it through civil disobedience. If it was good enough for Henry Thoreau, for Ralph Waldo Emerson, for Martin Luther King, certainly good enough for me and most other people. And that's the only way that change will ever happen. If you think you can go to the ballot box, I don't know how many times I've said it, if you think you can go out and throw out the bums, you're going to get a new bums, and you're not going to get anything different. As far as America goes, Larry, we both know there's not a dime's difference between the Republicans and Democrats, and it doesn't matter whether you've got a white president or a black president or a black and blue president or an electronic image or Mickey Mouse. It's going to be the same system, and it's a horrible system, and it's up to ordinary people to change it.
That's right. That's right. And I'm so glad you made that point, because it really does not matter at all whether the quote-unquote president is black, white, brown, turquoise, whatever, male, female. It really doesn't matter. It's about changing the system. We need real, genuine, systemic change, and that can only come from the bottom up, not from the top down. That's got to come from, as I keep saying, everyday, ordinary, black, white, brown, red, and yellow people, but just everyday, ordinary, struggling people. We're the ones who will make the difference. We're the only ones who can and will make the difference, and it's always been that way.
Yeah, it always has been that way, and people certainly a lot smarter than I am have said it, and they've lived it. I mean, important activists that have really gone through this, and they realize that they need to get people together to change their own futures, and it literally doesn't happen any other way. You work for it, Larry. I work for it. I really hope that many other people will catch on and do it themselves, because it's their own lives, and if they don't care about them, then nobody else is going to care for them. And
right.
I've lived long enough to see times considerably better than the way they are now. And they're literally so grim now that the opportunities I had growing up, and I didn't come from any special background, very ordinary background, in a very ordinary neighborhood, community, and so on. And yet there were opportunities for people like me that simply don't exist today. And I'd never gotten into the schools I went to. I never could have afforded them if they did accept me. I never would have had the job opportunities that I had. And things never would have turned out for me the way they did if I had been born 5 or 6 decades later. So I was lucky in that respect. And I feel sorry for most young people today because they don't have, dare I say, the advantages that I had. And, you know, people that come from well-off families, they have huge advantages. I certainly didn't have that at all. I had nothing going for me. But there was but the state of America then, which was full of warts and blemishes without question, I remember homophobia so bad. I remember just terrible racial discrimination. I remember lots of injustice that went on around me. I remember it in places that never should have happened. It wasn't in the neighborhood I grew up in, Larry, amazingly. I mean, that really did me a lot of good. What did me the most good was I had good parents, because I literally never heard my parents say one bad thing about anybody. So they taught me to love, not to hate. But the neighborhood I lived in was mixed. It was mostly white, but it was black also. And the only discriminating we ever did is we chose up sides to play the ball games that we did, you know, stick ball or touch football or whatever. We discriminated by who was the better ball player.
I hear you. Well, I think, my brother, you know, Stephen, I think that as ordinary people, I know that this phrase has been used before, but I want to tweak it a little bit. I really do strongly believe, I think history proves this to be correct. Certainly if one reads Howard Zinn's book, A People's History of the United States, one will see clearly that it really, really, really is ordinary people who do some incredibly extraordinary things, or at least can be creative and make some incredible differences that are real, not superficial, not fake, not phony, not fraudulent, but real.
Yeah, his book is absolutely marvelous. I had him on another program that I hosted. Oh, it's been a few years since he passed away. I think he was around 86. And he was old enough to be in World War II. He was a bombardier in World War II. He wrote about that in one of his books. He talked about it, the idea of, you know, killing people by pushing a button from 30,000 feet. He had no idea what's happening on the ground, and he was absolutely reviled by the very thought of it afterwards, that he had no idea how much harm he did to so many people. But I literally bought a number of copies of his book, A People's History of the United States, an extraordinary book. I did it because over the years, he updated it with new material, and I think I must have ended up buying 4 or 5 editions of that book. I never did that before, but I did it of his book, and I gave away some of the older copies, and I still have, I'm not certain I have the latest edition, I think I do, but I have the latest one that I bought on my shelf, and at least one other copy, and it really is marvelous. I think his wife encouraged him to write the book, and he felt inspired to do it because he said it. And I think he wrote it either in the People's History or one of his other books, that his entire education, all the way up to the doctorate level, never taught him what he most needed to know. So he decided he would write it. He would research it and write it on his own as far as the history of America, and that's exactly what he did.
And he himself, frankly, Stephen, is an example. I say is because he lives on through his writings, for sure. But he himself is an example of an ordinary person doing something that is amazingly extraordinary. I literally bumped into Howard. This was some years ago, obviously. I was at radio station KPFA in Berkeley. I was there to be interviewed on another program. Howard came in. And I thought it was Howard Zinn, but I wasn't sure. So, you know, I'm pretty straightforward. He sat down. He was in the waiting room to be interviewed on a different show on KPFA. And I said, aren't you Howard Zinn? And he said, yeah, I'm Howard Zinn. I said, well, you know, I've got to tell you, you have truly inspired me. I have learned so much from your compilation, especially from a people's history of the United States. We hugged each other. We talked to each other. Fortunately, the other programs or shows that they had on were running overtime. So we had about a half an hour where we could actually spend some time speaking just personally and directly with each other. I shall always remember and treasure that.
Oh, I envy you. I wish so much that I could have met him. Absolutely wish I could have met him. And he was one of the earlier ones who influenced me. And I can remember reading the People's History. He inspired me so much. I ended up reading, if not all of his books, pretty close to them, and they were all sitting on my shelf. Close to 20 books, something like that, of his that I've read. And they're marvelous and in very down-to-earth style of writing.
Yes.
And he was an extraordinary guy. He taught at Boston University, but he arrived there. Well, I didn't go to BU. I went across the river, but he taught there, and I had no idea what he was back in those days. He taught at a black school in Atlanta, Spelman College.
Mm-hmm.
And Alice Waters was one of his students in those days back in the I forget what the years. I have to go back and check what years he taught down there. But he went from Spelman up to Boston University and stayed there for years and drove the administration absolutely, absolutely wild because of the stuff that he believed in and stuff that he taught. But can you imagine having him as one of your professors and sitting in one of those classes and getting a real education?
I mean, that is just, oh, my God. I mean, you know, I only wish, you know, I have seen documentaries of Howard's work at Spelman. And, you know, one of the ironies, I think, the huge ironies, is that while the black students adored Howard, they adored him, because he was so principled, all right, the black elite, who ran the college really felt very threatened by him. And remind you of anybody today? Anyway, I won't even go there. The point is that he is, in my view, through his writings, he is and was a man. Not only his writings, his action, because people know him as only an author, but he was so much more than an author. Not that there's anything wrong with being an author, but he was a doer. He stood by his principles. He was principled. And you know what? That's what we need. We need tens of thousands of Howard Zinns, tens of thousands of Rosa Parks, tens of thousands of Malcolm and Martin. That's what we need. And they're out there. But we've got to cultivate them. And we've got to do it soon.
Yeah, we really do. And if there are enough of us, Larry, it's very hard for the power structure to pick us off. Years ago, before my time, or before I realized who he was or what he was doing, there was a great Chicago activist by the name of Saul Alinsky. And his most famous quote was that organized people can beat organized money. I think that's an absolutely marvelous quote, and it's so true. Organized money being the power structure, and organized people meaning enough committed people to deciding they're not going to take this anymore, and they're going to do something about it. And that is the real superpower. If that could ever happen, we've seen it. We've seen it come together in the past in America. We've seen marvelous things that have gotten accomplished, but we certainly don't see it today. And I thought I saw the budding of it with Occupy Wall Street, but it really is a shadow of what it was over 2 years ago. And that's exactly what we need. We need an Occupy America movement, nonviolent, committed, no matter what's going on, with millions of people getting involved in it. And again, I mean, all of us are in the same boat. I mean, we're either going to swim together or we're going to sink together. And
that's
if people
right.
don't come to that realization, then things will only get tougher and tougher. I have an article coming. I wrote it this morning. I'm not going to get it out tomorrow. I may get it out on Monday. I'll get it out before New Year's Day. And I simply called it 2014 Predictions, Larry. It's not pretty reading. I have nothing wonderful to say about the year ahead, and I began saying that, some predictions are best guesses, and some are much easier to make. Well, the ones I made are very easy to make, because it's very easy to just project what's going on, what has gone on year after year, under Bush, under Obama, going back under Clinton, the 1980s, but especially in the post-9/11 era. It's very clear what's going on. It's very clear how hard things are for so many people. The huge crimes against humanity that have been committed against billions of people around the world, the terrible force-fed austerity against people in America when most of the people in the country are going through a Main Street depression, and more cuts are planned next year. This is the system. So it's very easy to predict what's going to happen next year, and I just put it together in an article simply calling it 2014 predictions. It's not the kind of predictions I want to see come true, but I'm afraid they will.
Well, I think that the predictions, what you're doing and what I'm doing and others when it comes to talking about what's to be ahead, specifically in 2014, it's logic. It's the extension of, look, A plus B plus C equals, you know, and what we have to do, you know, I have to agree with you, my brother. I have to agree with you, the quote-unquote predictions that I see. Or foresee are not pretty. On the other hand, the flip side of that is the equation is not pretty. So we need to change the equation. That is really what we need to do. We really need to change the equation. Who was it who said that never doubt that a small group of thoughtful people can make a difference? In fact, it's the only thing that ever has.
Margaret Mead.
I think she is absolutely correct, okay? Absolutely correct. We need to change the equation. And all of this force-feeding of vomit, because that's what it is. I'm sorry to be so graphic, but it's that we're being force-fed vomit by the Obamatrons, Barack Obama, the Democrats and Republicans. We are being force-fed vomit by the corporate stream, news media, and I put the word news in heavy quotation marks. But see, you see, we don't have to accept that. We do not have to accept that. And we need to remind others, I don't care, black, white, brown, red, or yellow, we need to, and no matter their age, old, young, indifferent, whatever their age might be, we need to remind ourselves first and foremost, and each other, that we can change the equation. The media and the corporate-owned government would like us to believe that we cannot. I say, you say, Stephen, and there are actually many thousands, if not tens of thousands, of people just in this country alone who also say, we can change that equation, and damn it, that's exactly what we're going to do.
Yeah, we have to. I hope I live long enough to see the activism sprout up again the way it was in the 1960s and early 70s, Larry. I mean, that would be wonderful. I'm not getting any younger, and I certainly hope I'll live long enough to see it. But it's wonderful, and when and if it happens, you don't change things overnight. It can take years. I mean, the civil rights struggles that we both remember very, very well. My God, I remember it so well. I mean, it took many years to get real changes, and we had a different system in place at the time. I mean, we were at war, and that was bad enough. I mean, Vietnam, and Lyndon Johnson was certainly no jewel of a president. But he did what he did. He didn't do enough. I mean, his so-called war on poverty was more a pea shooter war on poverty. He could have done a lot more, but there was a lot of rumbling in the country, and I'm certain he decided he had to do something, or he felt there could be something much more serious rumbling than burning cities down and so on.
Right.
So he did. I mean, there were things that happened. We got the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. We got Medicare. I mean, those were wonderful things. And now they're being torn apart and literally thrown in the dumper. That's what's happening to them.
That's right. That's right. The very Constitution itself, you know, one of the things that my great fears, I'm sad to say, came true when I found out that back in 07 and 08 that Barack Obama taught constitutional law. I said, oh, my God, we are in serious trouble, because I knew that this guy, who was, in fact, groomed by the Central Intelligence Agency, but whether he had been or not, I knew that the system was installing this guy not to tweak and improve the Constitution or the human rights of everyday people in this country and around the world, Mother Earth. I knew that this guy was coming in to utterly destroy it. And that's essentially what Obama, what I call the Obamatrons, are attempting to do. But the beauty is, and I listened closely to what you said, Stephen, you said, we God. And you were absolutely correct. We the people, it was us, we, everyday people. I remember very well, believe it or not, in the 50s, I remember having to sit in the back of the bus in Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, okay? I was a youngster. You remember these things very, very well. You never forget them. However, I also remember having had the opportunity to see Dr. King and actually having met Brother Malcolm and spoken with him in 1961, I believe it was. Anyway, my point is more than individuals, I remember seeing people of all colors, of both genders, saying, you know what, we're just not going to take this anymore. And it wasn't just about racial discrimination. It was about economic apartheid. And that's what we're facing in this country again, even more so than ever before. I call it economic apartheid, which, along with all the social horrors that go with that, are worsening. And as you said, they will continue to worsen if we do not change the equation.
Yeah, it's a sad truth, but it's a disturbing truth. And again, it's the only way. And I certainly hope that something will happen to arouse people. I usually begin my days, Larry, going through the same drill. I generally write a couple of articles. I'll get two new ones out tomorrow. I got two out this morning. I'll get two more out tomorrow. And I always check to see, I mean, there's so much going on that I'm aware of, but I'm wondering what really needs my attention today, maybe updating events that are particularly striking, headline making, that I really feel that I want to say something about. Often I continue something, the same issue I've written a number of times on before, because there's new information that I think is important. It could be the Syria situation. I've written a number of times about what's going on in Egypt. I put out an article yesterday that I called Egypt's Pinochet, which is exactly the situation in Egypt, and I compared the reign of terror going on in Egypt against ordinary Egyptians to 1973 and thereafter under Augusto Pinochet, put in by Kissinger and the CIA, and
right.
The CIA was involved in getting the general running Egypt, General El-Sisi, running Egypt today. Same idea. There was a caravan of death in Chile. There's an Egyptian version of a caravan of death going on. People being shot in the streets, people being abducted, put in prisons, killed, tortured, abused in other ways. Same stuff went on in Chile. In Chile, there were four Americans killed. One, a movie was made for. I doubt there'd be any movies made for any Egyptian casualties. Certainly not an American one, maybe one overseas. But again, this stuff just repeats over and over again. And the title struck me, and I wrote about it. And it really is pretty gruesome, including some stuff I wrote about Chile. I picked up a couple of quotes by a couple of the generals, subordinates of Pinochet, who wrote about the things that they were ordered to do. It was very painful reading, taking victims, secreting them, torturing them, killing them slow motion, cutting off their limbs, shooting them in different parts of their body, places that would hurt them painfully, and making them die slowly, and then dismembering them with machetes and stuff like that. And this is the kind of stuff that went on. I wonder what's going on in Egypt today that I don't know about, but it could be stuff that's very similar to this. What's going on in Bahrain, the same thing, the brutality of the U.S.-supported regimes against their own people, and the disgusting irony, the disgusting hypocrisy, where America will criticize a government like the Assad government in Syria, who is defending himself against foreign invaders, death squads, the same kind of death squads that raised hell in Central America in the 1980s, killing ordinary people, attacking the supporters of the government, murdering them, torturing them, getting rid of them. And this is going on in Egypt, in Syria. And it's the job of the leader of a country to defend the people against what's going on. And the overwhelming majority of Syrians support the government for what it's doing. When a town held by these death squads is liberated, the people come out en masse and they thank the soldiers. That's the spirit of things in Syria. But this government, of course, calls Assad a cold-blooded killer, which he's not. And there really is cold-blooded killing going on in Egypt and in Bahrain and other countries, especially the Middle East ones. Terrible repression, Saudi Arabia. It's not mass killing there, but people are killed and tortured. They give lashes for punishment. I mean, very severe lashes that can cause great, great physical harm. And this is what they do to mete out punishment, plus doing all kinds of other stuff. You don't hear a word in the U.S. press. You don't hear a word of U.S. criticism. The stuff going on in occupied Palestine that keeps me busy all by itself. I've got a couple of new articles on Palestine. I've got a new one that I'll get out at tomorrow. I wrote a U.S. and Israeli season's greetings, and then I wrote a follow-up, which I call U.S. and Israeli season greetings, part two, explaining some of the stuff that America is doing and what Israel is doing. And it really sounds gruesome beyond imagination in some respects.
Mm-hmm.
A nightmare of horrors, day after day after day.
Yes, and when I think of Chile, and I immediately think of Palestine. When I think of Chile, I immediately think of Bahrain, of Yemen, of Saudi Arabia. When I think of Chile, I think of how the United States government, not the people. This is time for the people to stand up in our country. Time for us to stand up, right? But the United States government, in our name, has been butchering, murdering, funding murderers. When I think of Chile, I think of Al-Qaeda. I call it Al-CIA because Al-Qaeda was groomed. It was formed. It was armed by the Central Intelligence Agency. This is what I think of when I think of the death squads that continue. When I think of Chile, I think of, in a euphemistic sense, of how, in this case, for example, Barack Obama and his minions have numbed the will of the American people, and I put the word in American in quotation marks, so I should really say have numbed the will of the people of the United States. And in particular, numb the will of Black America collectively to collectively do for self. And we must do this. I say we every day, just ordinary folk, Black, white, brown, red, yellow. We must collectively learn and act to do for ourselves, because these murders, these horrors, this corporate blood sucking that's going on worldwide, throughout Mother Earth, but right here in this country, it just can't continue. We cannot allow it to continue, and we cannot allow ourselves to be numbed. So when I think of Chile of 1973, I think of here we are ending 2013, and how many other Chile are we dealing with? Lots. Far too many. One would be far too many. But we're dealing with Chile's Chile's all over the world. So, you know, I'm glad you brought that up. I'm very glad you brought that up, my brother.
Oh, there are so many Chilis around the world, and we hear about the infamous ones that get remembered in history, like the Pinochet regime. But there are so many despotic regimes ongoing right now in real time today,
yes.
Brutalizing their people, and we know nothing about it. We're going to take a break in a moment, Larry, very briefly. Earlier this morning, Press TV had me on, talking about the Muslim Rohingya people in the Myanmar, former Burma, now called Myanmar for some years.
Mm-hmm.
It's a minority population, less than a million people in a country of about 50 million, and these people are being absolutely brutalized. And I knew very little about them. I did some quick due diligence before I went on air, but the first thing that struck me so much was it seemed like what's happening to these people in Myanmar today was very much like Kristallnacht in Nazi Germany in the 1930s, except it's not going on for just a few days. This is going on day after day, week after week, month after month. But the comparison just stuck. People being murdered, tens of thousands being displaced, a mosque being burned, churches being, schools being burned, private homes being burned, extreme persecution, because they're Muslims, like in Nazi Germany, it was because they were Jews.
Mm-hmm.
That's the image that came to my mind, and it's happening in a country that is every bit as brutal as the Nazis were in the 1930s and early 1940s.
Mm.
Oof, I'll come up for here. Larry, let's take a quick break, and we'll come back and keep on with this.
Okay, brother.
Welcome back, talking with Larry Pinkney. Larry, again, there are so many directions we can go in. One of the articles I'll get out tomorrow, it's a follow-up to a previous one I did on the American Studies Association. They're the America's oldest and largest organization involved in the interdisciplinary study of U.S. culture and history. And their members, I think, are mostly academics, but they have researchers, librarians, even public officials and administrators, and the academic ones are, I guess, in most every academic discipline, and they have something like 5,000 members. It's an important organization. They came out on the record, and their members voted overwhelmingly to boycott Israeli academic institutions, and I wrote about it. I mean, it was marvelous what they had to say. True, absolutely true. They're not boycotting members of their staff, the professors or the students. They're not boycotting them at all. And they stopped short of boycotting the state of Israel, which is what I'd like to see, boycott the entire state. But they're boycotting Israeli academic institutions. Well, there was great hostility lashed out at them by university presidents. I picked up some of it, including my own. Drew Gilpin Faust, the president of Harvard, wrote a very, very brief critical response to ASA's decision. And there were others I quoted, University of Maryland, University of Indiana, Wesleyan University. I think that was the toughest one of all. And there were other universities that I didn't get. I probably could find things the president said, but other major universities were very hostile. Yale, Princeton, University of Chicago, Northwestern, New York University, Brown, Cornell, and I may have left a couple out. I'm sure I did. I'm sure there were ones I hadn't picked up yet I didn't know about. But they attacked ASA, and they did it wrongfully, because in researching my follow-up article, I made, you know, sometimes you find something you didn't know existed, and it made the whole article, and that's exactly what happened with this article. I found a study done, it was published a few years ago, and it was about Israeli academic institutions being in bed with Israel's military establishment. In other words, it's rain on terror on ordinary people. Muslim people, of course, literally in bed with them, including getting military officials to show up and be part of the classroom instruction, doing special favors to veterans of Israel's wars, stuff like that. And virtually every university, certainly all the major ones, I listed about 12 Israeli colleges and universities in my article, in bed with Israeli belligerents. It was right there in black and white documented, including some quotes. And just marvelous, and that made my whole article. And I have to wonder whether these president, U.S. university presidents, had any idea of this. Well, they will if they read my article. I hope maybe somebody will pass it on to them. It'll be out tomorrow morning. It'll be out tomorrow morning.
Great.
And I titled it U.S. Universities of Shame.
Wow.
Including my own.
Well, I mean, you know, I think that there's an absolute need for, since we're talking about Israel, there's an absolute need for people to understand that, you know, what the Zionist Israelis are doing to the Palestinians, to name a few, is not just directed at Palestinians. First and foremost, it is definitely Palestinians. We're talking about apartheid here. I mean, nothing short of apartheid. Economic, physical, political, we're talking about apartheid. And once again, the people, so many of us in this nation, have allowed ourselves to be numbed, N-U-M-B-E-D, numbed, to the atrocities being committed. But also right here in this country where AIPAC, the Jewish gangster lobby, and the Israeli gangster lobby. Let me correct that, because every Jewish person is by no means a Zionist, and many people are Zionists who are not even Jewish. So anyway, having said that, the gangster Israeli lobbyists, AIPAC, gang, as I call them, really controls. Imagine that. I mean, people in this nation need to think about that. Think about this. Controls to a very huge degree the policies and actions of our own government. Now, something is real rotten about that in Denmark, if you'll excuse the expression. But you know what I'm saying? Something is so upside down about that. The amount of money and arms that are sent to the Israeli state, and it is you, not to mention the fact that they talk about, when I say they now, I'm talking about the United States and the West in general, talk all this hubbub about Iran, and yet we have Israel, which has been and continues to be the major nuclear power in the region. In other words, they have hundreds of nuclear warheads. I mean, something is real upside down about that. Not to mention that they are committing on a daily basis genocide against the Palestinian peoples. Something is wrong about that.
Something is very, very wrong, and I discussed it in the article that I got out this morning. I think I may have said I'm getting it out tomorrow. I got it out this morning. That okay. I call U.S. and Israeli Season's Greetings, and it was part two. It was a continuation of the first article that I wrote, and I use Season's Greetings because, you know, this is the time of year, the holiday season, and this is the way America and Israel treats the people that they go after. So this is their notion of Season's Greetings. And I began my article with a statement coupling both countries together because they really are joined at the hip committing
yep.
Just gross crimes of war against humanity and, dare I say, genocide, guilty of genocide. And I started off saying no nations more egregiously violate legal, moral, and ethical principles, standards, and norms. None do so more contemptuously. None do more lawlessly. None mock the seasons more mark the season spirit. None more do it throughout the year after year after year. That's exactly what goes on. And I quoted from the 1950 Nuremberg Principles. There's so much to say about them, but just very briefly about them. Justice Robert Jackson, a U.S. Supreme Court justice, who was the main chief justice during the Nuremberg trials, and he called the number one crime committed by the Nazis not the crime of torture or mass extermination, the crime of aggressive war, literally the crime of war against peace, the greatest of all crimes, and indeed it is, because they lead to all the other crimes. When you wage war lawlessly against another country, then all of the other crimes follow. And if you don't wage war, then none of the other ever crimes would ever be committed. And he was absolutely right. And I made a discovery about Robert Jackson. I didn't mention him in my article. I've mentioned him a number of times in the past in articles. But amazingly, here's a guy who was a Supreme Court Justice, Larry. He didn't go to law. I don't know if he went to law school, but he did not have a law degree.
Wow. Wow. Now, what does that tell you about everyday ordinary people? Wow.
A big wow, indeed. A big wow. I mean, the guy had a brain, obviously, and
yes.
Anybody can read. I'm not a lawyer, but I quote the law so often, there are people who email me, and they think I'm a lawyer. I mean, they call me all kinds of things that are nice things that I'm not because of what I write and the things that I say, the laws that I quote. And it's amazing how many people think I'm a lawyer, but I'm not. Anybody can read. I mean, the stuff that I read, the international laws, are in plain English, and I can understand them. So I quote from them. It's just the idea of finding the right thing to home in on the issue that you're dealing with. But when you're dealing with crimes of war and against humanity and human rights, there's a lot of stuff out there. I've gotten very used to it by now.
Wow. Well, the fact that the guy doesn't, the guy you're just describing, the judge, okay, and he was the head judge at Nuremberg, wasn't he?
He was the head judge. He was an associate U.S. Supreme Court justice, not a chief justice, but he was the head justice at Nuremberg.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, now my respect is even higher for this guy learning that he did not have a law degree. What he had was good, everyday, ordinary principles, common sense, morals, ethics. I mean, oh, wow. No, I did not know that. You have definitely told me yet again something.
Oh, that amazed me, Larry. It absolutely knocked me off my feet. I couldn't imagine a judge at any level in America today not having a law degree.
Wow. Common sense. Woo. Power of the people. I want to mention really quickly someone that you know a great deal about and have been writing myriads of articles about. You are such a prolific writer, you know, Brother Stephan. But I want to mention Lynn Stewart. I want everybody to remember our sister Lynn, who's still incarcerated, who is literally dying in prison for having the unmitigated audacity to basically just come out and tell the truth and to vigorously defend her client, which she was not only entitled to do, but should have done as a serious lawyer, speaking of lawyers and judges. So I hope everyone will think of Sister Lynn Stewart, you know, and remember that she languishes in prison along with thousands of other political prisoners in this country. But let's not forget Sister Lynn. Let's remember her.
Absolutely. She happens to be a friend of mine, but she's absolutely languishing unjustly, and she is an extraordinary human being, a person who really gave of herself to help others most disadvantaged, poor people, people of color. I mean, just extraordinary what she did, and if anybody deserved better than what she's gotten, she's been in prison over 4 years now. She entered prison in November of 2009, so in Obama's first year in office. I mean, the simplest act of humanity on his part would be to simply get her out of prison right now because she is dying. She has stage 4 cancer. We've discussed it on this program. And she called herself back in school. She decided later, she was a librarian. She decided past age 30 that she wanted to be a lawyer and support the human rights that she believed in by doing it legally in a courtroom. So she went back to law school, and she had a couple of extraordinary professors who influenced her greatly, and she called herself not a particularly terrific law student, except a couple of classes from these professors that she really respected and loved so much, and those were the classes that she loved most. But you know, when you do things from the heart, you don't have to be a genius to do them well, and Lynn certainly did them from the heart. I must mention one other person, not a lawyer, but an academic, and amazingly, well, I shouldn't say amazingly, a man that I wrote about before, and I'll put out an article on him tomorrow, because on the 26th of December, he was an Israeli political prisoner, and they freed him on the 26th of December, but they had imprisoned him several times before. They never charged him with any offenses. Earlier, back in the 1990s, his name was Ahmed Karamesh, an academic, a human rights advocate, a political scientist, an extraordinary human being, just a Lynn Stewart type, Larry. Literally, a Lynn Stewart type, except he wasn't a lawyer. And he was put in prison for the crime of speaking his mind honestly and freely, which Israel does not allow Palestinians to do. So he was once administratively detained, as Israel calls it, uncharged and untried, once for 5.5 years. Well, he just got out just a few days ago after being administratively detained again for 2.5 years, and he was arrested at least one other time and held briefly. So going back a couple of decades or longer, he really has been pursued longer. It began in the late 1960s, I think, the initial brief detention that he went through. And then again, it might have been 3 or 4 times that he was in prison. And just because he's out, he's a marked man, and Israel could rearrest him anytime, which they've done so often with prisoners who they've released, who committed no crimes. They're political prisoners. In Kadamesh's case, Amnesty International declared him a prisoner of conscience. I mean, that's wonderful, but why doesn't Amnesty International declare all political prisoners prisoners of conscience? And we're talking about many thousands in America,
right,
in Israel,
right,
and in lots of other places. So to single out one is well and good, but not at the expense of all others. But he is free, and that's wonderful, and his family is rejoicing now, and I only hope he can stay free.
Yes, yes, yes. And he is yet another brilliant, he and Len represent two more brilliant examples. Remember, we started off the program talking about Howard Zinn and some of the many examples that he uses in his book, A Peace People's History of the United States. Well, these two folks that we've just been talking about, I'm sure bring a smile would bring a smile to Howard Zinn's face.
Oh, it sure would, and I wonder whether he may have known about Kadamesh. He certainly knew Lynn Stewart,
mm-hmm,
and I didn't know about Kadamesh until I wrote about him, oh, 2 or 3 years ago. And again, to read an extraordinary story like his, but he's not alone. There are many,
right,
not necessarily academics, but all types of people languishing in Israel's gulag, as I like to call it,
mm-hmm,
simply because they spoke their mind freely. They want Palestinians to be able to live free on their own land, in their own country, as I like to say. They'd be very happy to live under one state that isn't a Jewish state or a Palestinian state, but just a nation state for all of its,
mm-hmm,
people. And 20% of Israel is made up of Palestinian Arabs, but they're absolutely discriminated against viciously and ruthlessly. And, of course, the people in occupied Palestine have no rights whatsoever. They're living under the worst kind of police state repression, where literally they can be picked up. Any civil right or human right that listeners can think of, Palestinians are denied them all. They can't even carry the Palestinian flag publicly. They can be arrested for doing it. They can't speak their mind. They can't assemble in numbers more than 10 people outside or inside, anywhere. If they're caught with 20 people in their home having a meeting, they can all be arrested and put in prison. This is the kind of state that Israel is, and too few people understand this.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I actually, as it turns out, I was just talking to a Palestinian living here in the United States, and he had gotten back from Palestine about a year and a half ago, and it was very painful, very, very painful, some of the things that he was telling me, most of which I knew about, but nonetheless painful. We've got to stop this. It has just got to be stopped, and it's being done in our name, and Israel obviously has learned nothing from the totalitarian dictatorial governments that went ahead, that were before Israel came into existence. Nothing. We've got to stop it.
We've got to stop it. I was 14 years old when Israel was established, and I can't remember a single time that the subject of Israel-Palestine was ever mentioned by my parents. I don't know why. I'm certain they talked about some things that they didn't speak about in front of me and my brother. For whatever reason, maybe they didn't want to disturb us, I don't know. But, when we were tucked in and sleeping, maybe they discussed things that we never heard when we were together. It certainly wasn't mealtime discussion. And I never remember anything, but also, as I mentioned earlier, I never remember my parents saying a bad word about anybody. But Israel, I was 14, so literally I'm Jewish, and I was bar mitzvahed at age 13. So I was bar mitzvahed before there was an Israel. It was getting close.
Wow.
But it hadn't come to being yet, and I didn't realize exactly what went on to establish the Jewish state until years later. And the more I learned, the more horrific I realized just how bad it was. I mean, it really was just mass genocide, and it continues slow motion today. And I'll quote Francis Boyle, who's been on this program a couple of times. I certainly hope I'll get him back. We exchange emails all the time. It's tough to pin him down sometimes to come on here, but he certainly is a good friend, and we exchange emails this morning and yesterday, and we do it often. But he spoke specifically about the people of Gaza who have been living under siege, full-blown since the middle of 2007, and it really began around the middle of 2006 or earlier after Hamas was democratically elected. And he called what's going on, what Israel is committing, quote, slow-motion genocide. And the Israeli historian Alain Pape has said the same thing about all of Palestine, and I say the same thing as well. I mean, I've said it myself, and I can quote, and I've quoted both of them saying it. That's exactly what's going on, slow-motion genocide. It's not just Gaza. Gaza is the worst. But in the West Bank, literally multiple times every day, virtually 7 days a week, Israeli soldiers storm into Palestinian communities. They raid homes pre-dawn. They order people to open up. If they don't, they break down the door. They arrest the people. They can either beat up on them. They'll ransack the homes. They'll steal private property. They'll damage it. And this is what goes on all the time, literally every day of the week, multiple times. I've seen reports when as many as 90 times in a week, Palestinian communities have been invaded by Israeli soldiers, and multiple households have been broken into. And that's exactly what happened to Karamish the last time he was arrested, where the soldiers surrounded his house and literally stormed in, and even went upstairs to search an apartment above the home of Karamish and his family. Karamish was with a brother at the time, and they threatened his family members with machine guns to say where he was, to call him, to surrender himself, and if they didn't, they were going to harm the family. And he got on the phone, and he really lashed out at them, and he said, you know, this is my issue. Don't take it out on my family. And I quoted what his family said that he said, but he said it loud enough so they could hear it right through the receiver on the other end. Mm-hmm. But this is the way Israel operates, and this is the way America operates. We never hear very much about the terror that goes on against Muslim people and against immigrants south of the border, Mexico, Central America, brown people, terror inflicted against them, and we hear nothing about it in the major media.
Wow. Yes, we've got so much work to do. We can never complain about being bored, Stephen. We can never say that we're bored. There's so much work for all of us, all the listeners, to do. We need to link these issues. We really need to regain our humanity. Stand up. Stand up for what's right. Remember that program, Eyes on the Prize?
Part
of the song. Remember the song? It says, if it's one thing we did right was the day we started to fight. Let's stand up. Let's get our humanity back. Let's say no to this insanity, because that's what it is. Absolute global and national insanity. We've got to stop it.
Larry, we just went out of time. I must say that I feel so good at the end of the day. I spend every day writing and doing media work. I'm not a kid anymore, but this is what I want to do at this time of my life. And I feel so good at the end of the day. A perfect day for me is to write two articles, occasionally even three, maybe host my own program, have an interview, which I had this morning and yesterday, and feel what I call pleasantly tired. And I really feel as though I did something. It's my way of giving back for the blessings that I feel life gave me. And this is what I do. And everybody can do something, which I get asked all the time. I'm only one person. What can I do? Everybody can do something, anything. And if we do, just imagine the difference that would make.
That's
imagine
right.
How good you would feel when you do it. I feel absolutely marvelous doing this.
I hear you. Well, you and I are very, very similar in that regard, Stephen, because, you know, that is work. That's work. But it's working for the people, everyday ordinary people. I love you, my brother. I want the audience. I was going to ask you to tell the audience, but I forgot. I'm talking with the audience. Hey, thank you. Thank you to the audience. Thank you to everyone who's been listening in.
Thank you, Larry. I look forward to getting you back next month for more, and I urge people to dive into some of what I'm doing, but do it your own way. Don't necessarily do it my way. Do it your own way. Everybody can find what I call a labor of love, which is really for me. I'm older, so it takes me a little longer to get cranked up in the morning. I used to jump out of bed and get right into things fast. Oh, I still get into them reasonably fast, but I don't quite wake up as easily as I used to. But I look forward to every day and getting into what I do, which, again, I call a labor of love. and nobody pays me a dime, but it's wonderful. It's wonderful when you give back and have the joy of knowing that you try to help other people. Can't imagine anything better. Again, my thanks, Larry.
Thank you so much. Stay strong, my brother.
You too. Join us again next week, Fridays, 11 a.m. Eastern Time, weekends, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit, and have a happy New Year.